case on our oral calendar this morning. We're conducting this oral argument via Zoom. This case is A22-0129, State of Minnesota versus Michael John Merton III. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you choose to use it. For each of you, for your principal arguments, if you could please state your name and the party you represent for the record. And keep yourself on mute when you're not speaking. And otherwise, we're ready to go with counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Adam Lozo, and I represent the appellant, Michael Merton III. In my brief, I argued both probation revocation issues and a sentencing issue. I'll start by discussing why the probation revocation order must be reversed, but I also do want to address the sentencing claim to discuss and answer any questions on that topic. Probation filed a violation report alleging a single violation against Mr. Merton for drinking alcohol. Mr. Merton admitted that single violation. The district court revoked his probation and committed him to prison for 74 months. The order revoking probation must be reversed because the court abused its discretion in concluding the third Austin factor was fulfilled and erroneously applied the law for each of the three reasons it gave to revoke. First, and most importantly, the court impermissibly relied on unproven allegations from a pending criminal charge and not any facts that were admitted or proved at the hearing to conclude confinement was necessary to protect the public. Now, this court's precedent.
Judge Larkin, could I stop you there? Could you cite us to something that says that the district court relied on unproven allegations? Because as I read the transcript, it seems that the district court was very careful to say the only thing it had before it was this allegation of drinking, and to make sure the attorneys understood that, and to actually ask the state, okay, given that the only thing I'm going to consider on this allegation is the fact that he was drinking, how do I get to a revocation?
You are correct, Your Honor, that at the beginning of the hearing, the court clarified that that was the sole violation behavior. But there are multiple places in the record, and I will direct you specifically to them. The court stated on page 14 of the hearing transcript that what the court was concerned about regarding the revocation decision was, quote, it's the conduct associated with the alcohol, end quote, and specifically the unproven, quote, threats to kill that are in a whole different ballpark than the consumption of alcohol for me. That's on page 14 of the transcript.
And then were those threats to kill, was that a reference to the allegations in the criminal complaint?
To what was alleged in the criminal complaint, yes. And then on page 25, when she's explaining her decision to revoke, she says, quote, the judge says, quote, it's what you did when you were drinking that I'm most troubled about, and end quote, and specifies the allegation of, quote, being assaultive as what's troubling. Again, that's a reference to the allegation in the complaint. Finally, on page 29, when she's talking about—
I just paused you there. How do you know that one is a reference to the allegation of the complaint when there were previous disorderlies or assaults in connection with drinking? I think the state argues that's a broad looking at the history. How do you know that it's just the most recent allegation?
So she prefaces that comment by saying, quote, it's what you did when you were drinking. So she doesn't say it's what you did in the past when you were drinking. It's what you've done before when you were drinking. She says it's what you did when you were drinking. And then that's also clarified on page 29 when she's discussing the Austin factors. The judge says that, quote, harmful and, quote, assaultive behavior was the, quote, real concern supporting revocation. And so those things are not references to prior disorderly conduct charges. Those things are references to the allegations in the criminal complaint, which, if those allegations had ever been alleged as a probation violation and proven, certainly could have justified revocation.
But did none of the previous ones involve assault?
There is one previous violation for a fourth degree assault, but nothing involved in that case, as far as I know, involved actual physical harm or anything. It was a fourth degree assault. And
Mr. Lozo,
yes,
following up on Judge Smith's and Judge Larkin's excellent insights. And again, now I'm just speaking for myself. As I looked at this, when your client drinks, bad things occur. And have occurred in the past. So when I review the key, well, among the things you're arguing about, which is that, you know, he didn't really deal with the necessary for confinement outweighing the policies favoring probation. What I got from the judge's comments was, you know, when you drink, things are bad. So as a result of that history, I think now I can't trust you to just say you're not going to drink anymore. You've got to go in and, you know, what's going to happen is going to happen. And so apart from what you're saying is, you know, I get the whole argument is, you know, he's talking about these allegations of violence, but my picture is when your client drinks, bad things occur. Therefore, I think now you just keep drinking. Bad things keep happening when you drink. Now you've got to go in. I mean, it seems to me that would be the classic support for the third factor. So why am I wrong, counsel?
So there are three reasons that cut against that reasoning. So the first one is that sort of reasoning that this is part of an ongoing pattern would have the most force or be the most applicable here if there was actually any allegation or proof that that pattern was continuing. Here, the only allegation was simply continued drinking. The only proof was of that. And as there certainly is a criminal complaint alleging something different happened, but in this probation revocation violation proceeding, that was the sole allegation. That's what induced his admission to the violation. And that was the sole thing that there was any proof of.
His fourth violation. So are you saying that, well, it's just drinking. So whatever happened on prior, you know, your history of failure to comply with probation can never be considered. All we consider is this kind of, well, did you drink this time? And it's only, why should, you know, everybody can fall off the wagon. So for this time only, we give them a fifth chance. I mean, that seems to me to defy basic common sense to not be able to just look at, well, how has he done when he's been drinking? And the answer is he's not been doing pretty well. I fail to understand why we would silo it like that. That just seems to be not quite the way it works in the real world.
Well, to look at the record of what actually happened in this case, I would agree that the court is not prohibited from thinking about what has happened in the past. But what happened in this case was that the court didn't just do that. The court looked at what was alleged to have happened now and relied on that to revoke. So the court certainly isn't prohibited from considering things that have happened in the past, but the court is prohibited from basing the decision on unproven things about that are alleged to have happened in this most recent incident.
Counsel Judge Larkin, if we were to, I'm torn in this case because I appreciate the very specific technical argument you made about things the judge said on the record. And I'll give you that certain statements lend support to your arguments, suggesting that, you know, perhaps some erroneous considerations made their way in here. But, you know, maybe not, because it seems like you got to figure out how to interpret each of these statements that the judge made, and there's different ways to view them depending on the context. So when I was preparing for this case, because it seems like all of your arguments, you know, stem back to the Austin requirements and the Motlin requirements, I reread those cases. And it seems like, you know, those cases were really concerned about setting forth a process wherein we just don't automatically revoke. We want judges to explain their reasoning so we know that they gave consideration to the revocation decision and they provided some reasons that show that consideration and show us it wasn't an abuse of discretion. Despite, you know, the loose language here or there in the judge's statements, and I agree with you, they could have been a little more concise. I feel like Austin and Motlin are satisfied, as Judge Connolly explained. I fully understand why the judge decided now was the time to revoke. And I think that's the decision the judge made without looking at the complaint based on his history. If we were to say, nope, you know, some of these statements give us concern about, you know, the judge's reasoning, what's the remedy? Do we just say no revocation, or do we remand it for a hearing where the judge considers only the proper considerations?
So to answer your final question there, the remedy depends on what you conclude about whether the record contains sufficient evidence to revoke it all. So as I argued in my brief, my position is that it doesn't. If you look at these facts by applying the law correctly, that there isn't sufficient evidence. And in that case, the remedy would be a remand for a remand and directions to reinstate Mr. Merton on probation. If this court concludes, well, we think there's sufficient evidence if the judge, you know, were to apply the law correctly, he or she could reach that result on the evidence that was provided, then the evidence, then the remedy would be a remand for a new hearing.
And if so there was it a remand on what this for court a decided. New hearing, what happened with the criminal complaint that wasn't made a violation? If we remand for a new hearing, is there now a new conviction that's going to be argued as a basis for the revocation?
The complaint remains pending. So there is no conviction, no proven charge, no proven conduct.
What stops the state from adding that as an alleged violation, that conduct, and putting it before the court on remand?
What would stop the state from doing that? I don't know that there isn't anything that would stop the state from doing that. There may be. I don't want to say there certainly
Understood.
Isn't, but I haven't thought about that question. But the fact is the state certainly could have, when it filed its initial report here, could have alleged that as a probation violation and could have attempted to prove it. And if they had, and if they had been able to prove that that conduct occurred and that that violation occurred, this issue wouldn't exist. There's specific case law from this court that states that the state has the power and ability to do that, even when a criminal charge is still pending, and that if there is evidence that's actually submitted in the form typically of testimony to prove that that conduct occurred, that probation violation can be proven irrespective of whether a charge is even ever brought or whether it's still pending. I'll note that the state's counsel cited in its supplemental authority letter, an unpublished case called State v. Mann. And that case is actually helpful here because it shows exactly how this should be done to be done in compliance with the law. A witness called to testify that the behavior they're relying on actually occurred.
Mr. Loza, I was wondering if you could shift, because I know you wanted to talk about it, to your sentencing argument.
Absolutely, Your Honor. So I'll just start talking and you jump in when you want to. At the sentencing hearing, Mr. Merton moved for a durational departure at the sentencing hearing in 2014. The sentencing judge, who had heard all the testimony and viewed all the evidence at trial, gave a lengthy and detailed explanation of why Mr. Merton's offense was less serious than typical and granted the durational departure motion. That qualitative assessment of the facts of the case was within the appropriate role of the sentencing judge, and the decision to depart was the sentencing judge's to make. The court correctly did so and granted the durational departure motion. If this court affirms the revocation, the only remaining question is how much of a departure will be granted. Now, the state argues that the judge who heard the motion, who heard the contested motion, and who viewed all the evidence at trial was actually prohibited from ruling on the motion. No statute, case law, or guidelines provision requires that result, and Section 244.10 directs the sentencing court to make findings in an appropriate order on contested sentencing issues. But another major reason the state's proposed rule should not be adopted is that it would be extremely inefficient. It would prohibit the sentencing court from granting or denying a durational departure motion in these circumstances. That motion would remain outstanding the entire time the defendant's on probation. It would require the parties to relitigate the durational departure motion at every subsequent probation violation hearing. And it would
I was wondering what it means to grant the durational departure motion. I mean, we have case law, I believe, that even if a court finds substantial and compelling circumstances, it doesn't need to depart, right? So I can see that if there's a motion for a departure at sentencing, and a court finds that there are substantial and compelling reasons to depart, but then there's not an imposition of sentence, and then a sentence is later imposed, does the later district court have the authority, since you don't have to depart? For example, if the ruling on that motion had been, I find there are substantial and compelling reasons to depart, but there's no sentence imposed. I mean, it wouldn't be that inefficient later when a sentence is imposed for the district court then in imposing a sentence after a stay to decide whether based on those substantial and compelling circumstances, I choose to depart or not, right? Because you don't have to depart even if they're present.
So first of all, I would say that that issue is not present in this case because the court directly stated that it was granting the durational departure motion. This is on page 36 of the sentencing transcript, that it says, I'll just quote from it, that based on the quote, the rule of law and the facts that pertain to this case and this sentencing, to impose a sentence that is a downward dispositional and durational departure. So the court actually said that it was granting the durational departure motion. And second, I would say that when the sentencing judge is presented with a durational departure motion that is contested and makes a qualitative assessment of the facts of the case and finds that the facts of this case are, as a matter of fact, less serious than the typical offense, that decision would bind the court to grant a downward durational departure when that finding has been made. Now I see that my time is up.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Wald, and I represent respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. This appeal primarily presents one straightforward question. Did Judge Olmstead abuse her discretion when she revoked appellant's probation after his fourth admitted probation violation? The simple answer to that simple question is no, she did not. Appellant is not entitled to a fifth bite at the apple. While he takes offense at Judge Olmstead's decision and how she reached that decision, he ignores that he was on probation for causing the death of someone. He also ignores the fact that this was no mere minor violation or accumulation of minor violations over the course of years. Instead, appellant repeatedly violated probation by getting drunk, causing disturbances, being arrested, and then being convicted of a new offense or offenses. Because Judge Olmstead did not misapply the law or otherwise abuse her broad discretion, her decision to revoke appellant's probation should be affirmed. And I want to go to a question that Judge Larkin had asked appellant's counsel about. Did Judge Olmstead here actually rely on unproven allegations? And I think it's pretty clear if you read the transcript as a whole, it's a thorough transcript. It's 30 plus pages. And Judge Olmstead was very clear to both parties and particularly to the state to remind the state that there's only one allegation that has been alleged here, and that is the drinking violation. So it was very clear to Judge Olmstead that there was only one allegation and that she could only base her decision to revoke on that proven allegation, the fact that appellant admitted he had been drinking in violation of probation. I would also note that although Judge Olmstead did not base her revocation on this quote unquote unproven conduct, she very well could have, because appellant himself made a very broad admission at the revocation hearing, saying, quote, and saying, I sabotage my recovery by going to the bar and getting drunk. I then get rowdy and someone calls the police. And then when the police arrive, I resist arrest. He doesn't say, this is what I've done in the past, but I didn't do that this time, Judge. All I did was drink a beer, and you're going to revoke me for this? That's not what he said. He said that this is what I do, and those are, in fact, the very allegations in the new complaint. So Judge Olmstead could have, if she wanted to, base her revocation off of proven admissions that appellant made himself at the revocation hearing. But once again, she didn't do that because she knew that there was only one allegation, the allegation that he had violated probation by drinking. She then based her revocation off the fact that, unfortunately, for appellant, he has a proven history of drinking to great excess, causing a disturbance, getting assaultive, resisting arrest, picking up new offenses, and ultimately being convicted of those crimes and then admitting those violations. And under Supreme Court case law, the Judge Olmstead did not abuse her discretion by looking at the history of violations. Austin itself talks about that you look at, quote, the original offense and the intervening conduct of the offender.
end quote, when deciding whether or not to revoke probation. And that's exactly what Judge Olmstead did here. She looked at the original offense, the fact that this was a commitment to prison and a very serious level 9 offense, and then the intervening conduct of the offender, which—
Well, I was wondering if you could shift the sentencing issues.
I was going to ask the same thing. Could you explain what the state's position is on the sentencing issue? As I read the transcript, quite clear that there was a request for both a dispositional and a durational departure. The defense counsel argued for both and gave reasons for them. The state's attorney opposed the departures, argued that this is no different than any other typical manslaughter case. And the district court sentencing judge specifically granted both the request for a dispositional departure and the request for a durational departure. Why is that district court's decision? Why isn't the district court's decision that a durational departure was appropriate in this case not binding at the revocation stage?
Thanks, Judge. I wanted to say that it's— this is a challenging
issue, and it's hard for me to look at the rules and the case law and to make a 100% clear answer. As far as I can tell, this is the first time that this has come up before the court.
Well, I'm going to give you that. I was a public defender and a district court judge. We see all kinds of cases where someone gets a downward dispositional and an upward durational to settle a case. I've never seen a judge grant both, nor have I seen, quite frankly, a district court judge be so emphatic about the reasons for granting a durational departure in addition to a dispositional departure. And one thing that concerns me here is it was obvious what the district court was doing then and there, but your attorney at that hearing did not object to it. Your attorney said at the end of the hearing, I know it wasn't you, could the court please state the substantial and compelling reasons that justify departure? And the court said, I just did. The state's attorney did not say, well, wait a minute, you can't grant a durational departure if you just granted a dispositional departure. So didn't raise the issue there. Nor did the state appeal from that sentencing decision. And I mean, the rule says the state may appeal from a sentence stayed or imposed. I mean, arguably the state could have at that time first objected in the district court saying you can't do this, or appealed saying, you know, this judge just ordered a durational departure, which is to happen if there's ever imposition of sentence. We don't think the judge can do that. So it seems to me that, you know, to now ask us to go back and look at what the district court did 7 years ago, I'm not sure we should be touching this issue.
Well, to be clear, Your Honor,
it's not the fact that there was both a dispositional departure and a durational departure that is the problem, and that's confusing and a legal problem to the state. The issue is that there was a stay of imposition, which by definition, there is no durational length, and then a grant of a durational departure.
So why can't, and I mean, I've looked at everything. I don't see any rule or any provision in the sentencing guidelines or in statute that says a judge can't do what the judge did here, which is to say, you know, I heard the trial. I appreciate you're asking for both a dispositional departure and a durational departure. I think there are grounds for both. I think that I'm going to grant both, which essentially means that if sentence is imposed, it's going to be a downward durational departure. It's going to be less than the presumptive. Do you have any authority that says a judge can't do that?
I have no.
No, Your Honor. And that's the point that I was trying to make at the outset, is that this is, you're writing on a clean slate. And from my—
And the reality is what we're talking about here, if I'm correct, is 1 month. So technically we could, if we were to say, yep, the judge ordered a downward durational departure, that's the law of the case, that's what needs to happen, send this back, 73 months would be a downward durational departure.
Yes, appellant concedes concedes as much. And the issue for the state is sort of a logical and legal inconsistency between, on the one hand, granting a stay of imposition, which the law is clear, there is no sentencing length.
Although the case law is also clear that it is a sentence for the purpose of appealing. When the stay of imposition is granted, there is a sentence which can be appealed, which means that would have been the time for the state to make these arguments.
Although there, yes, but
there is the state, there is the opinion, and I'm blanking on the name, but it's in my brief, that talks about the time to appeal was actually when there was a, when there was a revocation. And this is the opposite, where there was actually an upward durational departure.
Right. And so that's not, that's a little distinguishable, because in that case, the issue is, all right, you just did an upward durational after a revo, and we've now had Blakely decided, and we need jury findings. So what we simply said is, if you're going to do this, you need to have a jury trial to get your findings to support this upward departure. We're way past that in this case. There was a trial. There's the defendant is entitled to have a jury make findings to support an upward departure. I'm not aware that the state has the right to have a jury make findings to say, well, there shouldn't be a downward. I mean, downward is completely different. So most of that case law on departures is arguably inapplicably, because it's dealing with rights that accrue to the defendant and not the state. So I'm having a hard time knowing what to do with the state's position here. Part of me feels that, okay, it's, you know, you're saying, well, it's logically inconsistent, it's an interesting legal issue. Well, then you should have raised it when it was presented before the judge who did it and appealed it then. I'm not seeing how you get back into court now, years and years later, to say, well, that judge shouldn't have granted a downward durational departure for these legal reasons.
Mr. Wald, would one argument you could make would be, or at least that I would think is, you know, let's say you appealed it back then and it rolled up here. I could see somebody at special term, or maybe me, saying, wait a minute, what? I don't want to see this now. This is premature. Who knows if he's even going to have who knows if the stay of imposition is going to be revoked? Come back and tell me later and make these arguments when he's been revoked, because otherwise it's like, you know, we've got enough to do. I mean, isn't that your strongest arguments about why you get to do it now as opposed to getting to do it, you know, 7 years ago? Would that be a fair statement, Mr. Wald? What do you think of that argument?
Yes, Your Honor, I think
that's fair. And I think that's why it is analogous. And I'm sorry that I'm blanking on the name of the case in my brief, but although it's not exactly the same, the reality is there wasn't a sentence length to appeal, and it would be
but there was a decision by the district court judge that the facts, as he stated them on the record, justified a downward durational departure. So you didn't know the number, and quite frankly, if this gets reversed for a durational departure, you can appeal that sentence, right? You can then say, okay, well, we disagree with this number.
Unless this court were to say,
no, the only time you could have appealed it was back when there was the durational departure was quote unquote granted. And it would be a little bit odd. Well,
let me ask, following up on Judge Connolly's question then, but even if we just say, all right, we'll tackle this now, we'll decide it. Can a judge do both a durational departure and a dispositional departure? What's the authority that says a judge can't do both?
Once again, to be clear,
dispositional departure and a durational departure. The Judge Leary here did a durational departure, a dispositional departure, and a stay of imposition. If he wanted to do a durational departure and a dispositional departure, he could have done that. He just can't give the stay of imposition, because then he could have granted
it. But isn't the stay of imposition? Well, I guess not, because it could have been a stay of X. But
yeah, he could have done a stay of X.
But since the judge can't do a stay of imposition and also say, I'm finding as the judge who presided over this case that these facts are not like the typical case and a durational departure request is granted. I mean, the motion was made and the judge ruled on it. I mean, it seems like you're asking us to overrule that judge's decision, to reverse the sentencing judge's decision that a durational departure was appropriate.
Yes, I think it would be.
I think, once again, it's confusing. I do think that there is a large logical argument to be made that asks, what is a durational departure? Now, a durational departure, sure, on the one hand, it's saying that this is less serious than the typical offense. But really what a durational departure is time off. It's less time in the box. And if you cannot say that because it's a stay of imposition, then has a durational departure really been given? I mean, I would say no. There has been no durational departure that was ever given because there was no sentence length given. There was no sentence length that was given because it was a stay of imposition. Okay. And just to respond to appellant counsel's argument about inefficiency, either way, there's going to be inefficiency because now if his argument is correct, that now Judge Olmstead has to look at and give a specific number, well, she's got to do the same analysis that the sentencing judge in the first place. She's got to decide, well, how much time off do I give him? Do I give him a month off? Do I give him half time? And that's going to be the same analysis.
The judge who presided at the revel, she was the only one in the courtroom who was aware that the sentencing judge gave authorized a downward durational departure because she said to the lawyers, okay, what were the reasons that the court said downward durational departure? And the lawyers said, well, at first we're hearing of it. And so, I mean, I am a little bit concerned about the fact that we have the revocation judge coming into the courtroom saying, and obviously she's looked at the transcript because she says, okay, the sentencing judge granted a downward durational departure. What were the reasons? The lawyers say, we don't know. And the judge says, well, it looks to me like the reasons were the defendant's conduct was not as serious as that normally associated with the offense. So, I mean, we have the revocation judge stating on the record that she's aware that the sentencing judge granted the motion for the durational departure. And she articulates the reasons that were given both by the defendant and by the district court judge. And yet she doesn't reduce the sentence beyond the presumptive length. Isn't that error?
I see that my time has expired, but if I may respond, I'm
not sure that your reading of the transcript is 100% correct. I know that Judge Olmstead did say that a departure was granted. She then asked the reasons for it, and the parties were not 100% clear on that, in part because of the age of this case and because Judge Leary did not file a departure order and did not clarify on the record when the state requested what exactly are the grounds for the departure. And it wasn't Judge Olmstead who then clarified what the grounds for the durational departure were. It was appellant himself who began to fairly accurately, I think, recite what Judge Leary spoke at length about.
You've read Judge Leary's comments, right?
Yes, I read the.
Do you have any doubt what his reasoning was for granting a durational departure?
I do not. I believe the durational departure was, yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Well explained. All right.
I see. I have no more time, but I just ask for that you would affirm Judge Olmstead's order. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah, so on the topic of what you were just discussing, Judge Larkin, the reason for the downward durational departure was that Mr. Merton was not the aggressor in the incident, and that among other reasons, that was the main reason that he was not the aggressor, and that made this this incident less serious than the typical offense. As you mentioned on page 30 of the transcript, the judge also said that she recognized, quote, that this was originally a dispositional departure and a downward durational departure. There was a question earlier in the transcript about, whether they had access to a sentencing transcript, which they did not. But the judge did say on that page 30 that she recognized that this was originally ordered as a downward durational departure. So you're correct about that. I'll also just note that the question about, well, if this had been a circumstance where substantial and compelling reasons found, but departure motion not granted, what would we do then? That question is academic in this case, and this court doesn't need to decide it because the departure motion, as noted in the sentencing transcript and the revocation transcript, was ordered. So at the very least, this court should remand for a decision on what departure will be granted. The state's counsel brought up an argument that he thinks that that would be similarly inefficient, which it would not be, because the facts of the case would not have to be re-litigated and refound. That's the part that would be extremely inefficient, is to require a fact finder to decide, make a qualitative judgment on the facts of the case. Judge Olmstead is fully capable of looking at the findings that Judge Leary made and deciding, you know, since the durational departure is granted, what sentence is warranted in this case. That's a less involved and frankly less factually qualitative procedure than having to relitigate what the facts of the case were, whether they were more serious or less serious, things like that.
Can I ask counsel apropos of that, and this just reveals my ignorance of sentencing practices, in a case where like there is a stay of imposition on sentence and then there's a probation revocation and there's going to be sentencing, do defendants never bring departure motions at that point?
Well, they can.
They can, right? I mean, in other words, we're talking about the inefficiency. You're saying it would be inefficient, but isn't that the practice that happens, that people do bring departure motions at the time of revocation? That inefficiency already exists, right?
Well, I don't know that they would be prohibited from doing that, but in a typical case like the one here, of course, the defendant doesn't know how the court will rule. So if the defendant wants a durational departure, he's going to make that motion at sentencing, as he did here. Whether a defendant would be prohibited from making that motion later, I don't think there's anything in the rules that would prohibit that. But as a matter of typical practice, the defendant would make both motions if he wanted them here, because he doesn't know if the dispositional departure motion is going to be granted ultimately. And in response, just briefly to Judge Connolly's question about whether the state, you know, had the ability to appeal this back 2014, I don't think that. Well, I certainly don't think that question, whether this court would have been accepted an appeal from that order. First of all, I believe the court should have, because it would have been a sentencing appeal and this motion was granted. It's part of the sentence. But I don't think that that's in any way determinative of the question here, because even if the state doesn't have the ability to appeal back then, which I believe they do, that doesn't mean that the judge couldn't grant the motion. There's a variety of contexts in which that something happens at trial, before trial, at sentencing, that the state can appeal as of right. That's part of the rules of criminal procedure. It doesn't mean that the district court judge is prohibited from doing that. If the court disagrees with me, maybe there's a problem with the rule if the state thinks it should have the ability to appeal that. But even if the simple fact that the state might not have the ability to appeal, which I disagree with, doesn't mean that the district court can't grant the motion.
Well, what about the fact that the state didn't even object to this procedure at the time it happened? I mean,
100% correct.
It's like, okay, set aside from the state appeal, on appeal, we generally don't consider arguments that weren't raised and determined in the district court. And when it was crystal clear what the district court was doing and the state didn't object to it on the basis it's giving here, which is, it's legally inconsistent to have both a stay of imposition and a downward durational departure. You can't, what the state says is they're mutually exclusive. That right. Argument wasn't made to the district court. So I wonder if that in and of itself is a reason.
Right. Well, which is another reason. I see my time has expired. Can I answer the question? That in and of itself is another reason that the state's argument shouldn't be accepted in this case, as you just laid out. And I'll rest there. I agree, Judge.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments and your briefing. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in the statutory time period. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you. You too.